Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. Some IT administrators are returning to work after the long holiday weekend here in the U.S. to a shock. Perhaps thousands of businesses have had their data held for ransom by a gang of cyber criminals known as R-Evil. The hackers apparently exploited a weakness in a software company called Kaseya, and the attack continues to rip through computer systems around the world. Let's bring in Alan Liska. He's an intelligence analyst at the cybersecurity firm Recorded Future. Alan, welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on, Jane.
Well, tell us the significance of this attack, who's affected, and what it means for their businesses.
Well, and that's the interesting part. It's basically companies all over the world, and large and small. Many people probably saw that Coop, one of the largest grocery chains in Sweden, was completely shut down over the weekend because they couldn't process any payments. There are multiple companies that have been infected, again, small, medium, and large-sized.
Does it look like there was any sensitive information stolen or any other motive for this attack beyond the $70 million ransom that R-Evil is asking?
That's a really good question. So most modern ransomware attacks, as you point out, do have a data component to it. So the ransomware actors steal data and they publish it to an extortion website. In this case, that didn't happen because of the way the ransomware was deployed. They used a vulnerability in the Kaseya virtual system administrator to push the ransomware down. So they weren't able to steal files the way they normally would.
Mm. So this apparently affected thousands of companies, as you say, large and small, and public agencies around the world. But it's not like every one of them was individually attacked. So talk about the security breach at this one software company. It's called Kaseya. How did it spread so far so fast?
So what this was what we call a zero-day attack. So the attackers took advantage of a previously unknown vulnerability in this software. So it wasn't Kaseya themselves that were impacted. It was the vulnerability in their software. And because this particular software is exposed to the internet, basically all the attackers had to do was scan for any system that was exposed to the internet running this software, and they were able to exploit it. And they exploited what were referred to as managed service providers. And managed service providers provide exactly that, managed IT services for small to medium to even large companies. And they use that then access from the MSPs to deploy the ransomware.
Mm. So R-Evil is the same group that successfully extorted $11 million from the world's largest meat processor, JBS, just a few months ago in the United States. Does this attack suggest that they're getting more sophisticated or just getting bolder?
Right. So R-Evil's been one of the most sophisticated ransomware actors that have been out there. And it's not the first time that they've used previously unknown vulnerabilities. But this is a next level. This is something new that we haven't seen before from them, where not just an unknown exploit, but actually an unknown vulnerability that hadn't been seen before. It's a combination of the fact that they are getting more sophisticated, but also they have a lot more money. So, you know, there are bad guys who specialize in selling exploits and doing this kind of research on the underground market. And with the money that R-Evil's made from people paying ransom, they've been able to reinvest that into buying these exploits, buying previously unknown, specifically zero-day exploits, and using that against their targets. Mm.
Well, the CEO of Kaseya said that his firm's clients, the ones that were mostly impacted, were dental practices and architecture firms and libraries and plastic surgery centers, things like that. I mean, you mentioned this is next level for this R-Evil group. I mean, what's next?
We don't know. I mean, really, this could go one of two ways. They could continue to get bigger and bigger, but The timing of the attack is also very bad for them because governments have spent the last 2 months trying to figure out how to cooperate on ransomware in general. And now all of these governments that have victims are going to be focused their attention on R-Evil. And that's a lot of attention for even somebody as sophisticated as R-Evil. So this is truly an international attack. It's not just U.S. focused.
Mm-hmm. Well, President Biden suggested just last weekend that the U.S. would respond if it was determined that the Russian government had a role in this particular attack. The hackers are based in Russia. I mean, even if there is no evidence that Russian officials directed this cyber attack, does it put more pressure on the Biden administration and the Russian government to do something about these cyber criminals?
It absolutely does. All this summer, it's been one escalating ransomware attack after another, from Colonial Pipeline to JBS to now this attack. As these continue to grow, that's going to put more pressure on the White House, and the White House and the rest of the world governments are going to put more pressure on Russia to do something to stem the tide of these attacks.
Alan Liska is an intelligence analyst at Recorded Future. Alan, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you very much.
The White House is pushing a new strategy to get more vaccine shots into arms. This move comes after President Biden fell just short of meeting his goal to have 70% of adults at least partially vaccinated by July 4th. Meanwhile, COVID-19 cases have increased 5% in the past 2 weeks, but they vary widely from state to state. Let's bring in Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's an emergency physician who teaches at George Washington University. She's also the author of the upcoming book, Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. And she's on Skype. Dr. Nguyen, good to speak with you again.
Thank you very much. Good to join you.
What is new in this new strategy?
Well, I am not sure what is new, because frankly, the White House has been doing a very good job when it comes to increasing supply, working with local community partners. I think that what they're doing now, though, is tinkering around the edges. I think that we need something a lot bolder from them. And specifically, I want to hear President Biden basically say that it really matters if you are vaccinated, as in it's not just about you. I think there is this live and let live attitude that's been pervasive, which is, why do you care if other people are vaccinated? If you want it, get it, but let people do whatever they want. Well, actually, we need to be saying that there is a risk even to people who are vaccinated by unvaccinated people around them. And so I hope that the Biden administration will get behind vaccine verification. I hope that they will encourage employers to make vaccines a requirement, or at least to make it opt out instead of opt in. Something like that will have the dramatic effect that we really need at this point to increase vaccine uptake and stop the spread of the Delta variant.
It's possible that the days ahead are more difficult than the days behind us. In other words, the states that are relatively low in terms of vaccination, Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, where 35% or less of adults have gotten a full dose, maybe quite difficult to convince people there. Would the bold moves that you have just suggested work in places where there is political a political will to resist vaccines?
Look, I think we need a combination of approaches. The states that you're mentioning with low vaccination rates, there are a lot of people there who are not convinced that COVID-19 is real. They may have gotten complacent. They may have seen that all the restrictions around them have been lifted, and so there's not a real threat to them. And they also have heard misinformation or disinformation about the vaccines. And so, yes, we have to overcome that kind of distrust with accurate information, with credible messengers. But I also think we need something more in order to get people to overcome their complacency. And so I think at this point, we need to decide what are the societal values that we really care about. Are we about protecting the rights and liberties of the minority who have not gotten vaccinated? Or are we trying to protect the health and well-being of the overall public, including children who are not yet able to be vaccinated, and immunocompromised people who don't have the immune protection, even if they have gotten the vaccine? Who are we trying to protect here?
We also have an issue with variants, specifically the Delta variant, which is really rising, especially among unvaccinated people. And we're seeing issues, especially in states like Wyoming and some of the states that I've mentioned, where as things begin to reopen, as people gather for public events, the Delta variant is really gaining ground. What might we be able to do about that?
Well, you're right. The Delta variant is far more contagious than any of the other variants that we've seen thus far. And so it's quickly becoming dominant here in the U.S. We have seen cases, including there was just a report in Texas of 125 campers and staff members who tested positive. And we don't know that it was the Delta variant, but likely because of it. And so I think we really need to, again, emphasize that the pandemic is not behind us at all, that the unvaccinated are at high risk from one another. And also that even if you are vaccinated, if you are living in an area of high community transmission, you should really consider wearing a mask indoors again if you are surrounded by potentially unvaccinated and unmasked people. The danger is there even for those who are vaccinated. That should not undermine our trust in vaccines, but rather it should increase our how much we are on guard against this variant.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, an emergency physician and professor of public health at George Washington University. Comedian Bill Cosby plans to return to work. That's what his spokesman said last week as Cosby left the prison where he'd served 3 years for drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Constant, a woman he had mentored. Lisa Lott Lublin is one of more than 50 other women who accused Cosby of sexual assault. She joins us from Las Vegas, where she's a teacher. Lisa Lott, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me, Celeste. I appreciate the opportunity.
How did you find out that Cosby was going free?
Oh, boy. Many times now I've been at work with students when I found out about situations with Cosby, and it happened again this time. My response was, are you kidding with me? Is he actually getting out, or are they talking about him getting out? And I was blown away. There was nothing to prepare me for this. There was no lead up to it. And it was just as surprising for me as I'm sure it was for everyone else.
I wonder what effect you think this might have on other women who have to make the difficult decision you did, whether to come forward and testify, whether to come forward and make police reports. How do you think this might affect their decisions?
Oh, this is going to be a huge impact negatively towards women, men, children who feel that they're going to be heard and that their perpetrator's going to, you know, be held accountable for their actions. That's always been the scariest part for victims to, you know, rehash, put all their information out in the open. It's devastating. Absolutely devastating. And then on top of it, it's that the celebrity's going to go free. So if it's someone of stature or power or, you know, influence in some other ways, you know, they feel like they're totally left alone.
You said before that the only thing you wanted from Bill Cosby were, and I'm quoting you here, an apology. Take responsibility for his actions, some remorse. Have you seen that?
Absolutely not. He still does not even, I mean, he's walking out of jail, throwing his hand up saying, I'm innocent. I always said I was innocent. You were never exonerated from being guilty. You just happened to get out of jail because you tweaked the system. I would sit and I would say, please just let him stay in jail as close to 3 years as possible, because at 3 years, he would have been available to do parole. And I think, honestly, that his punishment and his consequences is going to start showing up now, because now that he's out of jail, he's going to have to start facing the public and the ridicule. And it's already happening. The situation with Felicia Rashad and Howard University, that is just boiling and boiling and boiling and boiling over.
Let me just remind listeners what you're talking about. Felicia Rashad, who starred with Bill Cosby in The Cosby Show as his wife, tweeted the following after his release: "Finally, with a number of exclamation points, a terrible wrong is being righted. A miscarriage of justice is corrected." That's the end of her tweet. She later, after a great deal of pushback and criticism, put out a clarification saying that she supports survivors coming forward. And as you say, she's a dean at Howard University, and they put out a statement as well supporting survivors that come forward. What do you make of this sort of pushback and debate that's happening in real time out in public? Because Bill Cosby is so well known and so famous, these discussions and debates are happening in the headlines.
Well, because I think that going through the trial with him and how it piggybacked on the Me Too movement, this was setting a precedent that there has got to be a change. You know, we want to change rape culture. We want to change the system for prosecuting, you know, perpetrators. We want to make victims feel that they are safe and that they have a reliable place where they can come in and talk about what's happened to them, and that there will be some sort of recourse for someone harming them.
So I wonder how you are grappling with all of this, not only what happened with Felicia Rashad and her walk back, not only with Cosby's release, but how do you view this at this point? It must have taken so much to decide to come forward, to decide to testify. And now knowing that he served 2 years only, what do you make of this? Is it progress?
I think it's absolutely progress because, again, everything that was done in the court system to find him guilty, he was guilty. They did everything right. If 65 women are accusing you of rape, why is there a statute of limitations in general? This is a crime against a human being, their body, their soul, their mind. It absolutely destroys their life and changes the pattern and pathways that this person is going to take forever.
Lisa Lott Lublin is one of more than 50 women who accused Bill Cosby of sexual assault. Lisa, thank you so much for continuing to speak up.
Thank you, Celeste. I appreciate it, too.
Bill Cosby's conviction has been overturned, and we're left with a lot of legal questions. Fatima Goss-Graves is president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center. She's also a co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. So, Fatima, this conviction was pointed to as more than just one case. It was a symbol that even with a defendant as wealthy and famous as Bill Cosby, you could get a conviction. What does it mean now that that's been overturned?
Well, it's important to remember that as Me Too over the last few years has really taken off, it's never been about just one powerful person. It's really been about the power of survivors to change our culture and to change the ways that our laws work in practice. And so I think the Cosby case and even Bill Cosby's release really has revealed the many, many flaws in our criminal justice system. And I have a lot of hope that survivors will take up that mantle, too.
Now, Bill Cosby claims he is innocent. Is that what the court decided?
It's super important that everyone is reminded that the decision that freed him did not address innocence at all. It was really a legal issue about a promise that a prosecutor may or may not have made to him in 2005. And so nothing about the decision negates the fact that that Bill Cosby himself admitted in a deposition that he drugged women. Nothing about the decision negates the fact that a jury of his peers convicted him. And the many, many people who came forward bravely with a lot of risk to themselves, you know, that's who's on my mind and heart in these days, because I know they are so rightly disappointed in the way the system failed them.
It does call into question how difficult it is to get a conviction in these kind of cases of rape and sexual assault, in that Bill Cosby had 50 or more accusers, And it's still, he still ended up getting convicted, but then again, his conviction was overturned. So what does that tell you about what needs to happen next?
Well, I have to say that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision was really a highly unusual one, because here there wasn't actually a written agreement, you know, and so I'm not sure that you will see a broad application of this Bill Cosby rule in a lot of other cases. It really read like a decision that might apply to Bill Cosby and only Bill Cosby, and that brings up a range of power considerations. Part of the problem was the prosecutor didn't initially believe the woman who came forward. And the not being believed, not taking the concerns and claims seriously, is part of why it's hard to get a conviction in the first place. You know, most sexual assault isn't ever reported at all, but for those who do come forward and do report, they face people all along the way who disbelieve them, who disrespect them, who disregard them. And we have to look at this as a giant example of that, that has huge consequences, not just for the individuals in the Cosby case, but for the many people who are wondering whether they too should come forward.
And well, the next question then would have to be, for those people who are wondering whether they should come forward or not, how concerned are you that this will have a chilling effect?
It's my hope that the opposite will happen, that it will be a galvanizing moment for survivors, and that it will be a giant wake-up call for prosecutor offices around the country, around the steps that they have taken over the last several years, and whether or not they are meeting this moment. To meet this moment, we actually have to have spaces where survivors can get justice, can get accountability that feels real to them. And what's in place right now isn't working. It's not serving survivors well.
Fatima Gross-Graves, president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and a co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Fatima, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Three years ago, a man with a grudge murdered five people at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Maryland. And now, finally, his trial has started. What we wanted to know was, how did the staff who survived the shooting keep going? Find out in our Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded podcast.
Oil prices climbed on Tuesday to a six-year high, with the global benchmark reaching over $77 a barrel. It comes after talks with OPEC and other oil-producing countries over production levels broke down on Monday. To help us understand the significance of this, we're joined by NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, thank you. Let's start with this OPEC standoff. What were the cartel members talking about, and why did the talks unravel?
The oil-producing countries are trying to navigate this gusher of new demand for oil and all the things that are made from it, like gasoline and jet fuel. If you think back to the early months of the pandemic, nobody was driving or flying anywhere, and demand was so depressed, the price of oil actually fell below zero for a little while. OPEC and Russia responded by slashing oil production by about 10 million barrels per day. Now, of course, the economy is recovering, more people are driving and flying. So demand for oil is rebounding, and the producing countries have to figure out how quickly to open the taps. They did boost production by about 2 million barrels per day during the spring, and they're expected to keep producing more in the months to come, but they're not all exactly on the same page, and that's creating some uncertainty in the market.
And so what impact is that having on oil and gasoline prices?
Well, oil prices hit a six-year high when the talks broke off. The price has since retreated a little bit. Brent crude, which is the international benchmark, is in the mid-$70 a barrel range. The U.S. benchmark is about $1 a barrel lower. Goldman Sachs has forecast that oil will go to $80 a barrel this year, and they're sticking with that forecast. There's always this trade-off for the producing countries. They want to get a high price for the oil, but not so high as to choke off the recovery. Of course, the U.S. is not as dependent on imported oil as it used to be, thanks to the shale revolution, but oil's priced on the global market, and producers in this country are not eager to flood the market either and push prices down. Mm.
So what does this mean for drivers here in the United States?
You're going to pay more at the pump. AAA says the average price of gas is now $3.13 a gallon. That's almost a dollar more than it was this time last year. Of course, last year's price was artificially low because of the pandemic. A better yardstick might be the 2019 price, and gas is more expensive than that, about 35 cents a gallon more. It's still way below the peak price, though, of more than $4 a gallon, which was set back in 2008. Obviously, nobody likes paying more for gasoline, but, you know, travel over the July 4th holiday weekend was expected to be the second highest on record, topped only by 2019. So after a year of pandemic-induced immobility, I don't think too many people are going to, you know, cancel their summer road trip plans because gasoline's gotten a little more expensive.
So, Scott, how does this all fit into the larger story that we've been talking about of inflation?
Well, you know, gasoline prices tend to go up and then come down. That's why economists often exclude these volatile prices from the so-called core measure of inflation, not because the price hikes don't matter, but because they are often followed by price drops. And, those ups and downs don't really tell us about the general direction of inflation. The jump in gas prices right now, like many other price increases we're seeing, is really a byproduct of an economy that is healing and the resulting surge in consumer demand. You know, gas prices do tend to have an outsized psychological impact. They're the most visible prices in the economy with those giant signs on the street corner. But unless you're a long-haul trucker or an airline, the price of fuel is probably not a huge part of your overall budget.
That's NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley. As always, Scott, thank you.
You're very welcome.
When U.S. forces left Bagram Airfield last week, they turned the lights out, literally. They shut down the electricity and slipped away in the night without notifying the base's new Afghan commander. Kathy Gannon is the AP's news director for Afghanistan and Pakistan. She spoke with some of the Afghan soldiers inside the base after the Americans left, and she joins us now to talk about it on Skype from Kabul. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jane. It's a pleasure.
It seems sort of shocking the way the U.S. left this base that had been so critical to the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan. Tell us more about how this played out last week.
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. It is quite an incredible story. What happened was that the remaining U.S. soldiers left late on Thursday night. The Afghan commander, who is now in charge, had expected to hear when the departure would occur. And at 7 a.m., he went into Bagram and discovered that they had left. They had left about 2 hours earlier. According to some of the soldiers that I spoke to, the electricity had gone out about 20 minutes after they had left. And Bagram Airfield is really quite enormous. It's like a small city, the area that the U.S. and NATO controlled. So it literally plunged into darkness as they left. And I guess a small army of looters saw the darkness because these giant floodlights that have been on for forever were gone, and it was just plunged into darkness. So they literally plowed through the northern entrance of the airfield and spent the next few hours ransacking the place until the Afghan National Army arrived and took control, arrested some, evicted others, and gained control. One of the soldiers said that they received a call from the U.S. Soldiers saying, "We're now in Kabul at the airport in Kabul." That's how they were made aware.
And the looters that made their way through the airbase, were they Taliban?
No, they weren't. But one of the soldiers that I spoke to, he said, when we got in, we didn't know who were these people. We thought maybe they were Taliban. No, they were looters. They literally just ransacked, took whatever was not nailed down in the time that they had. We were there 3 days later, and they were still cleaning out the junk that these looters had left behind. You know, they drank the water bottles, the energy drinks. There was wrappers, everything all over the place. Items thrown around, and they were literally just still shoving all this garbage into garbage bags and cleaning up. And I said, "Where did all this come from?" And they said, "Oh, this was the looters. We're still cleaning it up." So,
do you know why there wasn't any communication from U.S. forces? Why they just turned out the lights and left?
Clearly, the U.S. did issue a statement, and they did say that, you know, the whole departure and winding down of the war that has been going on for nearly 20 years has been in the works for several months. They certainly are in conversation with the leadership. But the actual departure of the base was not shared with anyone, as far as we could tell, and from what the Afghan commander said. And it as a result, you end up having to speculate that they perhaps feared that some information would get out to the Taliban if they did specify exactly when they would leave. There was a sense among many of the soldiers that we spoke to, Jane, a feeling that a lack of trust in those final hours of the departure.
Kathy, Bagram Airfield also included a prison with about 5,000 prisoners, many of them Taliban. What will happen there now?
The prison has been under Afghan government control and Afghan military control for several years. There is two or three perimeters of security surrounding the airfield. So it's not an easy area to breach. The Taliban at this point, in terms of their surges, their winds, there isn't a real push or a surge that has been seen at this point of the Taliban in that area.
Kathy Gannon is the AP's news director for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Kathy, thank you for bringing your extraordinary reporting to us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jane. It's a real pleasure.
This summer, the federal government planned to give billions in debt relief to black farmers in recognition of how it denied them loans and assistance over generations, giving white farmers a leg up. But now the effort has stalled. It's been temporarily blocked by federal judges. David Kondos of the Kansas News Service reports that even if the payments do go out as planned, some black farmers believe they'll come too late to reverse the decades of damage caused by discrimination.
Johnella Holmes walks along the edge of a field of golden wheat near the northwest Kansas town of Nicodemus.
And so this section right here.
She heads the Kansas Black Farmers Association. And back in 1877, her great-great-grandfather joined the wave of homesteaders who staked their claims here.
All of this was black owned at one time. 6 by 6 miles, black owned, black settled, and I wanted you to just see just how vast it is.
Nicodemus is the last remaining town out of many that were settled by formerly enslaved people who migrated from the south to the western frontier. Kansas alone had about a dozen black farming colonies.
When you think about farming in the historical context of African Americans and migration, what you see is the land is the draw.
Angela Bates is another descendant of those Nicodemus settlers. She runs the town's historical society. At its peak, she says the land here was home to nearly 150 black farmers. But today?
No one's farming in Nicodemus right now.
There's a few black farmers who live in neighboring towns, but not many. It's a pattern that's repeated across the country. 100 years ago, Kansas was home to upwards of 150,000 acres of black-owned farmland. That number's now closer to 10,000. Nationwide, about 90% of the acres that were once black-owned has slipped away. Thomas Mitchell is a law professor at Texas A&M University and a member of the Land Loss and Reparations Project research team.
If something is not done in the next few years, the next generation, meaning like 30 years from now, we could literally be talking about there's only a few hundred black farmers left in this country.
Mitchell says systematic discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture drove one black farmer after another off their land.
This wasn't the exception to the rule. This wasn't a bug. This was a feature of the system.
By the government's own admission, many black farmers couldn't get money to buy land or operate their farms because they were denied credit for bogus reasons. And when the farmers filed complaints, the USDA often did nothing. So now the federal government is offering around $4 billion to make amends, paying off loans of farmers who survived despite racist policies. But Mitchell says his team's preliminary research puts the actual amount of wealth black farmers have lost at $300
billion. I got something to show you.
Bernard Bates, Angela's cousin, was one of those farmers. At his home west of Nicodemus, he thumbs through a stack of faded color photos from when his farm was foreclosed on nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah, that's when they loaded some of my machinery. They sold our machinery first, then they sold the land.
Among the papers on his desk sits an affidavit from a local loan officer. It says the credit association denied Bates the help he needed to keep his farm afloat, deliberately to push him out of farming. His 950 acres, the homestead, even the wheat he had harvested, were all taken away.
My wife tells everybody, yes, if I had a gun, I said I'd probably shot somebody. Because we've done worked all hard all year, and we still damn watched some steel wheat all night long.
Bates was part of a landmark USDA settlement in the 1990s that was supposed to send billions to black farmers who had been treated unfairly. But he says he's still waiting for that money.
I haven't got a penny yet.
And now, the new federal effort to help black farmers is already getting pushback. White farmers have sued, claiming discrimination. Federal judges have temporarily blocked the payments. Jonella Holmes, the head of the Black Farmers Group, says her organization has received threats over the idea of debt relief going to African Americans. Yet, she figures only a quarter of the farmers she works with will even be eligible. And many of the farmers who do qualify are skeptical about signing up. But if the relief helps any black farmers in Kansas hold on to their land, she says it could be one step toward making things right.
Do I want handouts? Absolutely not. I just want to be treated fairly and put in a position where we can be at least on the football field.
For Here and Now, I'm David Kondos in Nicodemus, Kansas.
As sea levels rise and hurricanes menace the country's coasts, Georgia recently celebrated the 50th anniversary of a landmark law that protects its shores. As Molly Samuel from member station WABE reports in this story we've aired previously, the law was part of an effort to preserve an iconic state landscape, the salt marsh.
Georgia doesn't have a very big coastline, only about 100 miles. But the coast it does have is lined by salt marsh, a muddy expanse of tall grass and meandering creeks between the mainland and the state's barrier islands.
I don't know that anybody could look out across the Georgia salt marsh and not be filled with ecstasy.
Georgia writer Janice Ray, on the edge of the marsh, says there's something about the scene that's mysterious and vast. It looks still, but down in the marsh, it's filled with life. Fiddler crabs, oysters, and birds.
The things that you eat, you know, the fish, the shrimp, you know, a way of life.
I don't think anything will survive without the marsh.
Ernest McIntosh Sr. is a commercial fisherman and oyster farmer.
I mean, we have to have it. You can imagine no marsh? No, it wouldn't be right.
The marsh's value and its beauty might be taken for granted now, but in the late 60s, there was a proposal to mine Georgia's salt marsh, to dig it up, then fill it in. The fight that followed eventually led to the passage of the Coastal Marshlands Protection Act in 1970. It was a progressive law for its time, though other states now have marsh protections too. Still, Georgia, with its relatively small coastline, has about a third of all the salt marsh on the East Coast, close to 400,000 acres. And all that marsh is helping Georgia adapt as the sea level rises.
It's very incremental. It's very slow.
Jill Andrews is with the state's Coastal Resources Division.
We'll get these calls of somebody calling and saying, I just don't understand why I have all these fiddler crab burrows in my vegetable garden, or they weren't there before. You know, we hear that again and again. It wasn't there before.
She says it's not only marsh animals like fiddler crabs. People also see salt marsh plants moving into their yards. Sometimes it's more acute, like during the highest tides of the year. Megan DeRosiers is the executive director of the Georgia Environmental Group 100 Miles.
You can't cross roads. Sometimes you can't even go outside.
She says one time the tide got so high it affected her commute.
I had to walk through water. I'd take off my shoes, hike my pants up, and walk through water just to get to my office door. And there was a sunny day.
In Georgia, climate change is causing sea levels to rise by about 3 millimeters a year, which may not sound like much, but it adds up.
3 millimeters per year is about a foot per century.
Clark Alexander is a coastal geologist at the University of Georgia.
We have data for the last 80 years. It shows us that sea levels have been steadily increasing.
By about 10 inches so far, and they'll continue to do so, and likely at a faster rate in the future. And Georgia's marshes, they can move too.
Our marshes are able to migrate under the uplands.
And the 50-year-old Georgia law that protects the marshes follows them. The way the law works, you can't develop or fill in or drain the marsh without a permit. For those permits, you need to first figure out where the marsh is. And one way the state does that is by checking for certain marsh plants. Wherever they are is considered marsh. Jill Andrews with the Coastal Resources Division.
So to that extent, the Marsh Act can be responsive.
Basically, as sea levels move, the salt marsh moves, and the law moves too. But this isn't just about the salt marsh being protected, because the marsh itself buffers Georgia from sea level rise.
So the marshes play a very important role in protecting what's on the upland here in Georgia, particularly right along the edge of where the water and the land meet.
Clark Alexander with UGA says the marshes slow down water that might otherwise flood into dry areas. They also absorb waves. Without the marsh, powerful waves from storms would slam right into the land and erode it away.
As opposed to nowadays, where we see a lot of that wave energy being absorbed by the marsh grasses, just waving back and forth and knocking the wave energy down before it reaches our shorelines.
Georgia is working on ways to adapt to and prepare for increasingly high tides, asking local governments to plan for sea level rise and protecting open space so that the marshes can keep moving inland. But Megan DeRosiers with 100 Miles says there will come a time when the marshes and the 50-year-old law that protects them come so high up that they clash with private property.
So the question is, if the marsh moves inland, what happens to the boundaries of the marsh and what happens to the boundaries of private property? I think we're still trying to figure all that out.
But she says Georgia is in better shape than a lot of other states when it comes to sea level rise, because it's already protected so much land on the coast, and it's protected its marsh. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Samuel in Brunswick, Georgia.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now.